Happy Bitcoin Tuesday, freaks. I know it's been a few weeks since you've last heard a dispatch. That is on me. But I haven't been on vacation. I have been working around the clock on the next chapter. Got a lot of big things planned. First and foremost, I was in Oslo for the Human Rights Foundation Freedom Forum. It was an extremely rewarding experience. You will hear more about that in the future. I shot a small documentary series that we hope to have edited and released, at least the first couple of episodes soon. So there'll be more details on that. In addition to that, we have launched something called Bitcoin Park, a very special initiative in Nashville. It's going to be a mix of a community center and social club. We have all dedicated to Bitcoin. We have an event space. Nash Bitcoiners is going to be held here tomorrow. Over 200 Bitcoiners will be there. You'll be able to buy burgers with sats. There is going to be workshops here. There's a whole co-working space. We're right near the two colleges in Nashville, Belmont and Vanderbilt. So we will be ideally doing dev workshops with the youth of our nation to hopefully bring them into Bitcoin development. We'll be doing self-custody workshops, all different sorts of events here at Bitcoin Park. And in addition to that, we have a brand new Bitcoin TV studio here, which Dispatch will be broadcast from going forward. I'm hoping to do more in-person conversations on Dispatch than through the internet. It's always just more enjoyable, and I think the conversations come out better. Starting with today's conversation, we have... Oh, and also, this is literally... I've just been setting up the studio today, all day. It's a very minimal viable product in here right now. So apologies to our guests who are here, but also apologies to the listeners. That is why this is the first dispatch without a bumper, some mainstream media clip that we can all laugh at together in 5 years. It does not exist on this one, and we will not be ending it with a music video. On that note, though, I am going to be doing another rip here for Dispatch tomorrow that will also go live. I'm thinking that's going to be around 1700 UTC tomorrow. And hopefully I will have the setup fully set up for that. And you will get the dispatch you know and love. So to the ride or die freaks out there, I just want to thank you again for supporting the show and keeping it ad-free, sponsor-free, dedicated purely to actionable discussion. I really do appreciate you. I couldn't do it without you. Once again, the easiest way to support the show is to go to citadeldispatch.com. I have a BTC Pay server there. You can also use podcasting 2.0 apps like Breeze and Fountain Podcast to stream sats to the show. And if you remember, at least the ride or dies, remember I said 3 weeks ago that if you use the Boostagram feature on podcasting 2.0 apps, which is where you put a message and choose how many sats you want to send, that I will read the top ones. I know it has been 3 weeks, but got to give credit where credit's due. We have Chad Farrow here. He contributed 50,000 sats to the cause and says, loves the idea of reading the top boost on each episode. I'm curious to see what the freaks have to say. FYI, a boost with the message is a boostagram, but I'm just being picky. Thank you, Chad. And we have Mary Oscar said, amazing episode. Hoping all the Fountain users can help you realize your goal of staying ad-free and 100% audience funded. He contributed 30,000 sats. And then we have Bon, who contributed 25,951 sats, very specific amount of sats. And he said, I started an experiment in April, and this is now the second month of doing it, and I like it. I load up Fountain with a Netflix subscription amount of sats every month. Instead of streaming sats per minute, I now just boost an amount at the end of a show based on length. Shows with ads get 5 seconds per minute, and no ad shows get 20 seconds per minute. At the end of the month, if there's a balance in Fountain, I then dump the remaining sats to shows with no ads. This boost of 25,951 is an example of that, value for value. And then Vake said for 4,000 sats, stay humble, Vake. Thanks, Vake. You're always a supporter. But anyway, if you use a podcasting 2.0 app, you can read everybody's boosts after they send them, which is pretty cool, on each episode. So if you want to support the show, that's a fun way of supporting it. If you contribute one of the highest boosts, I will read it tomorrow, I guess. So get those in. Maybe you can get a nice cheap one in, you know, if no one else gets it in. Okay, so with all that said, this is a special rip because it's the first one in the new studio, first of the new chapter. I have return guest Seth for Privacy here. How's it going, Seth?
Hey, Matt. Thanks for having me on, man. I'm really excited that worked out to jump in, check out the new studio, and chat with you.
It was nice. It was just a surprise.
Yeah. Yeah. No kidding.
figured out he was in town. Was it last night or this morning? Figured out this morning you were in town.
Yeah, I think this morning.
Fuck yeah. Yeah. Love to see that happen. And then we have Nico, BitVolt 7 from Simply Bitcoin here. How's it going, Nico?
What's up, man? I'm super happy to be here. I just want to say Matt completely undersold this studio. I've never heard though. Better acoustics in my life. There's literally no... Was it reverb? What?
Echo, reverb,
echo,
anything.
There yep. Echo. There's no echo. It's perfect. I love it.
Well, I mean, the irony... Thank you, Nico. The irony of Nico saying that is I do have him on a... I have him on a wireless mic. So if he's a little bit lower, worse sound quality than me and Seth, don't hold it against him. That is my fault. I take personal responsibility for that. And if we didn't completely bankrupt ourselves on Bitcoin Park, we will invest in some new mics for the third and fourth guest. Because I really like party episodes. I want to have more party rips in here.
Yeah.
I feel like it's a really good room for party rips.
Yeah, you could do a big group in here.
So what do you guys think of Bitcoin Park? I like gave you both the tour.
I had no idea where I was pulling up. Uber dropped me off and it's pretty mind-blowing. I mean, this place is perfectly set up for a lot of stuff that you've been doing and obviously want to do. But it really looks like a haven for Bitcoiners and just really kind of freedom-loving people. So excited to see where the cafe goes, where all the event space goes.
Yeah, we have a fucking cafe. Yeah, I'm pretty excited. I'm bummed, Seth, that you won't be here for Nash Bitcoiners, but
I know I may have to see if maybe I can move my flight or something. Yeah, we'll see, because it would be pretty sweet to be able to tag along while I'm in town anyways.
But. Yeah, you should consider it. It's a good time. It's gonna be Nico's first time. He's gonna fucking love it. It's a special group of people we have that come here.
I might move out here. This place is awesome. this is a complex. That's what it is. You gotta call it for what it is. I'm just excited to see how this plays out. I think with Bitcoin, we always say, you know, Bitcoiners are going to take over and all that. I think this is part of the process, man. I think this is definitely a step up.
Going to move into that producer studio right back there. Just lay a nice mattress.
Just give me a closet. I'll be happy.
We got a bunch of couches here.
Perfect.
Well, anyway, we'd love to have you. So, I mean, I just like both of you guys. So I don't really have, and someone asked me what the topic of today's conversation was, and I just don't have a topic. We just have a new studio, and it's a Bitcoin Tuesday, and the freaks haven't heard from Scylla Dispatch in 3 weeks, so you guys are both in town. I just kind of made it happen. Well, I guess before we get started, I didn't shill the Matrix chat. If you're not in the Matrix chat, go to scylladispatch.com and click that scylla.chat button. Even though we haven't had a Scylla Dispatch in 3 weeks, that conversation in that chat has been fucking fire as usual. So if you're in that chat, not only are you participating in the live chat for the shows, but there's also just really great discussion on privacy, freedom, and Bitcoin in that chat. So I mean, where do you guys want to start? Do you have something you want to talk about, or
I just want to do like a notable mention because I saw it and I think it'd be interesting to get your guys' opinion. The Lummis bill, right?
Oh, that's a fun thing to talk about.
I didn't get a chance to look into the details, but I don't know. What do you guys think? Look, I'm not a fan of government, of regulation, but I don't know. What are your guys' opinion on this? I don't know what to think because I haven't looked into it.
Yeah, I haven't read the bill. I mean, obviously, like you said, it just dropped and she's been kind of teasing it for a few days now. Definitely always wary of stuff like that. I mean, I think a way that the state could kind of prevent a lot of Bitcoin's power and a lot of Bitcoin's good use cases is just trying to kind of co-opt it and fold it back into a broken system. So I'm very wary of like state-sponsored pro-Bitcoin stuff. But that's not to say that good things can't happen through regulation. It's just that regulation, especially cryptocurrency focused regulation, is usually a tool that gets used against freedom and doesn't promote it. But like I said, I know nothing about this bill specifically, so I'll have to dig in and see a little bit more of that.
I guess it literally got released this morning.
Yeah.
I mean, I tend, like, in general with Seth, what Seth said is kind of where I stand. I always say, like, when you see, like, the headline, like, breaking Bitcoin legalized somewhere, what it really means is it's just, like, Bitcoin users in that country now have even more overbearing KYC regs.
Yeah.
Usually the case. In this case, I did read through it briefly. First, I will say, not to be a Debbie Downer, but probably zero chance this thing gets passed. But it's still good to see that it was proposed. And it was, I'm not a big politics guy, but it was proposed. Lummis did it with Gillibrand, and Gillibrand is a big on the progressive side. Mm. So Republican woman, Democrat woman together do the bill. Good to see. But the one thing that was in it that was, I really like seeing was a de minimis tax exemption. So Bitcoin spends under $200, which I'm a very low amount regardless, but wow. At least it was in there, right? This idea that, you know, you shouldn't be, if you're just using this as a currency day to day. And it's not even just the, you know, actually paying taxes. I think a lot of people support paying taxes if it's, you know, being spent efficiently or whatnot. It's the mental cost of actually, like, every time you do a, you know, $5 transaction or $6 transaction or something, that you have to, like, keep track of it and do that. So that was good to see. I kind of just saw that part and I was like, oh, well, that's awesome. And then I just didn't really read the rest because I was setting up the studio this morning. The other thing that was really cool that came out today, or maybe even cooler than that, because I don't know if that's the coolest thing, is Gladstein and a bunch of activists basically did you see the tech innovators? I'm doing quote unquote tech innovators that, like, posted, they, like, sent a letter to Congress.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they were like, Bitcoin and cryptocurrency is just bad for people. But they were like, most blockchain projects have horrible privacy and the ones that do are safe havens for money launderers. Like, they just, like, attacked on both sides. Like, damned if you do, damned if you don't. And they were like, stifle us with heavy regulations. Gladstein and, like, 19 human rights activists from around the world basically did the opposite of that letter today to U.S. Congress. And I think it was financialinclusion.tech is where that letter is.
Yeah. Shout out to David Zell of the Bitcoin Policy Institute. Absolutely crushing it. That I always say this, they function as the Bitcoin lobbying arm. That's really what they do. And I think that in the next couple of years, it's going to be very important. Every time I talk to David, I'm like, when are you going to move to DC? And he absolutely hates that question because I think he knows it's inevitable.
He's a Nashville boy.
He is a Nashville boy, but you gotta get into the heart of the swamp, you know, to deal with the creatures. So, yeah, shout out to...
That sounds like a horrible life.
That's what it is. That's what it is. But someone's got to do it. That's the thing.
Yeah, maybe, like, Zell hires someone underneath him to do it.
Someone's got to do it. Someone has to do it. And it can't be Coin Center, okay? Because they totally drop the effing ball. Even though Jerry Brito, I know he works hard, but I think it's important that Bitcoin has its own lobbying arm.
It's kind of cool that there's a bunch... Like, the whole lobbying politics thing is something that I think the whole point of freedom tech is that you can ignore that shit.
Yeah.
But it is good to see that there are so many, there's multiple now Bitcoin only lobbying firms that aren't, like, focused on DeFi and tokens. And
I think during the transition, they're going to be very important. Because look, whether we like it or not, I think fiat's going to be around for a good amount of time. Right. So until we get into a Bitcoin standard, I think, you know, as much as Bitcoiners hate politics and whatever, I'm a strong believer in, look, I'd rather have these, as many of these people on our side than have some adversarial people, right? So that's kind of the logic that I have, even though I think politics is a shitcoin and hopefully Bitcoin makes it irrelevant.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely one of always those interesting pieces, because like lobbying has obviously a lot of bad connotations, and people understand that it's something that's leveraged for a lot of very, very negative things kind of in the political world. So doing it for Bitcoin has always been a weird kind of paradox for me. I understand the point, and it's one of those things where like I would never get involved in it, but like I have respect for the people who do it and do it well and are actually trying to promote things that promote freedom and not just kind of fitting Bitcoin into a broken system. So I think there is a space for that, and like especially the explanations to people to get them to understand like what Bitcoin actually is. But I definitely do think we need to be wary that we don't kind of just get slowly boiled in a regulatory pot where they're able to kind of slowly take control and make it so that, yeah, you can have your Bitcoin, but you can't use it the way you want. Because ultimately, if we lose that freedom money, that freedom tech piece of it, we're losing what Bitcoin ultimately brings to us. So that's always where, like, I think there's a hard line to ride there, but there's definitely been some interesting and good work done specifically on educating people within the government and educating people who are big names, at least, on what Bitcoin is.
So Gladstein, I was just in Oslo, and Gladstein, he like got a bunch of activists and some Bitcoiners and brought them to Norwegian Parliament to educate them. And I was not invited. And I'm pretty sure it's like every Bitcoiner has different strengths or whatever. And he was just like, he's going to walk into Norwegian Parliament and just be like, fuck all of you. I don't want your regs. I don't want you involved.
Probably not the perfect person to be the pro-regulatory Bitcoin person.
I mean, so. But that's the beauty of this kind of thing, right? Is that Bitcoiners find, you know, what they can contribute, and they help, everyone has their different skill sets and they focus on different things.
And I think it's a very optimistic approach too. Yeah. I think like one of the reasons why I trend against the regulatory lobbying, all of that, is because I guess maybe I'm a little bit less optimistic about the way that a tool like this can work in the current system. But I do like that, like there's a lot of optimism in the people who see that maybe Bitcoin can fit in as a tool to slowly improve the system rather than like burning it to the ground. Cause like anarchy has a lot of problems. So if we can do it in a way that's peaceable and slow and yet still get the most out of Bitcoin and the things that it can bring as a tool, I think there may be value in that. And it's a very optimistic view.
I think that, you know, part of the reason that Bitcoiners, well, let me speak for myself, better said. I think that we know deep down inside that if a politician supports Bitcoin, what they're really doing, whether it's directly or indirectly, they're really sacrificing their power, and they're giving it up. So, I mean, the people that are meant to so-called regulate the industry, the incentives are not aligned whatsoever. That's kind of the way that I see it. Obviously, you know, there's some, but I think that a lot of these bureaucrats are parasites, and they feed off the fiat system. So they're not incentivized for that system to go anywhere. And these are the same people that are supposed to regulate. Like, I don't know. That's how I feel about it.
Yeah. I think definitely a little bit of pushback there on my end. I mean, I don't know. I don't know that they are trying to give up power as part of that. And I think most of them, there are probably some ones that are very much want to bring freedom through politics, which there are very like good, sincere people. They're few and far between in the political world, but there are some there. But I think Bitcoin can very much be leveraged as a tool to continue their power. It's not something that just, if we do nothing, will break down a broken system and bring a perfect world. And I think that's one of the traps that I see a lot of Bitcoiners and other people, I mean, I even think people in other projects, talking in a way that kind of the Bitcoin is inevitable thing. And I think that can lead to a lot of dangerous things, like the current very KYC friendly crowd that is a lot of Bitcoiners, but really just a lot of people in the whole cryptocurrency space, very pro-regulation. Many are pro-chain analysis, which is absolutely nuts, but there are many people that are like that. And a lot of that stuff comes from politicians who know that they can actually turn Bitcoin into a tool that, if nothing else, does nothing to break down their power. And in some ways could even improve it. And I think like the KYC stack sats thing is an example of that, because it feels like, what, Matt?
I just gave Seth a look. I don't know. I just feel like stack sats is a bigger meme than KYC stack.
No, that's why I was trying to be specific. because like people who are stacking sats in a way that is KYC free and like they're using BISC, they're using AztecGo. Yeah, or miners.
Shop owners.
All those are like the right way to approach it. Yeah, building circular economy, great way to stack sats working for Bitcoin. There are really good ways to do it, but I was trying to be specific in like that I'm talking bad about the KYC stack sats. Like you just set up your dollar cost averaging and you walk away.
Post the screenshots on Twitter.
Yeah, exactly, of how much you just bought in Cash App every 3 hours. That I think just that kind of thing, people can get pulled into this trap of thinking Bitcoin is inevitable. And even though I sacrifice all of the freedom principles that I care about now, if I do it and have more Bitcoin, that's going to fix the world and that's going to fix my future. And I think that's definitely something we should be wary of, and is something where that could be leveraged to be an easy trap for the few people who actually are freedom focused. Because then, I know Matt's talked about this a ton. This is a common topic, is how KYC can lead to a nice tidy list of Bitcoiners that they can go to. Most are just going to give in, and the few that fight, they're going to now have their name on a list and all of that. So I think just a little pushback on that idea, and a lot of what I hear about the kind of the Bitcoin is inevitable thing and sacrificing for that Bitcoin is inevitable beam, I think is a dangerous value proposition.
So one sec. So the first thing is circular economy. The idea of bootstrapping a circular economy is something that I've become very passionate about. And I think there's a lot of momentum there. And it's one of the focuses with the Bitcoin Park initiative. And also this idea of like these grassroots Bitcoin communities popping up, like it's really fucking cool. All these meetups that are just growing around the world. And they're happening at a time when everyone was locked down and most people weren't seeing each other, but these Bitcoin communities were growing and they all pretty much grew organically. There's not like a top-down thing that's happening. So ultimately, on the KYC conversation, I always kind of go back to, it seems mostly like it's a pain point of our current position in the adoption cycle, because most people will not be buying Bitcoin in the future. They will be earning Bitcoin, and most people will not be selling Bitcoin. They'll be spending Bitcoin. I forget who said it, but someone said like a good, I don't love the meme. I actually love the meme, "We're still early." But I don't love the comment, "We're still early." But someone made an interesting comment that as long as you're buying Bitcoin and selling Bitcoin, you're still early, because 99% of people that interact with Bitcoin for the lifetime of Bitcoin will not be buying or selling it. They'll be earning or spending it. And I don't think we're late. I think everyone who comes into Bitcoin always thinks they're late. Like I thought I was late when I came in. But I want to point the question at Nico, because this is something that I've drunkenly been asking Bitcoiners a lot. All over Oslo, I was asking this. The question is Bitcoin inevitable?
Absolutely. I think that sorry to push back a little bit on Seth.
No, go for it.
I think that the incentives are irresistible. A good example of that, in my opinion, I think this was the second biggest stress test that Bitcoin ever endured. And it passed it with such flying colors that if you weren't plugged into Twitter, or you weren't checking the hash rate, or you weren't checking the news, if you were just using Bitcoin, you would have had no idea. And that is, the Chinese Communist Party banned Bitcoin mining within its borders without any central authority or nothing. The hash rate decentralized, went all over the world. There's a bit of a concentration in the US. I don't like that.
Way too much in the US.
No coercion. It was all incentives. And the incentive is so strong that in China, it's estimated that between 10 to 20% of the hash rate is still located in there. That means that there's Chinese that are risking to lose it all, or the government themselves or corruption that are still mining it. And that's the incentive. That's how strong the incentives are. And I think that government money, specifically CBDCs, they'll have to rely on coercion. So in my head, the equation is simple, right? I think incentives are much stronger than coercion. And I think that over the long run, that will prevail. But that doesn't mean that specifically in totalitarian governments that don't want to give up that power, they're going to try whatever it takes, use whatever coercive measures, whether that's, try to make it on the app store where every single wallet that you use is KYC or some BS, because you know they're going to try that, or try to ban self-custody.
Yeah, the app store attacks haven't really happened yet. That's definitely going to happen.
That's 1,000%.
I feel like 90% of Bitcoin users, if their Bitcoin wallet gets removed from the app store, they're going to be like, oh my God, what the hell's going on?
It's gone. And what worries me, what keeps me up at night, right? So again, so to answer your original question,
yes,
right, it's inevitable. And to kind of pivot a little bit, if I may.
You could, your floor is yours, bro.
We were talking about this a little bit when we were having those delicious burgers. Dude, what scares me is I don't think people are ready for self-custody. They're just not. Like, I don't think they're ready for that. Like, and I see it in people's faces, especially like the older generation. I'm like, you just got to write down those 24 words. You got to put them on metal. You got to put it in the safe plan. They're like, they've been so in the matrix for the majority of their lives, in the fiat matrix, that you just shock them with this like better system. In my opinion, it's a lot easier and a lot safer, that their brains just can't compute it. And I think the vast majority of the world is like that. Are you telling me that person, El Salvador, selling those pupusas knows how to properly store their seed? Or are they using?
But they might be using a mobile wallet that is self-custody.
But that's a lot of trust in that.
But they might not be actually backing it up. They're probably not using their own node.
That's a lot of trust. And when trust is involved, governments could exploit that, right?
Right.
You get a government agency, it's like, okay, only government-approved wallets in the app store. And then you start exactly where you started, right? It's the whole FDR thing over again. Right. You give me your gold and I'll give you this dollar. I promised it's backed by gold. Right. So we're right where we started. So I think that the fight for self-custody and the educational thing is so important. And I think that that's something that they're definitely going to attack, just how they're attacking proof of work right now. I think that the next inevitable step is attacking the right to self-custody, because it's such a revolutionary thing.
That was in the Lummis bill.
Self-custody?
The right to self-custody.
That's bullish.
The right to self-custody, the terminology was digital assets. Hold your own digital assets. They were definitely on point on that, to have that on. I mean, look, at the end of the day, right, this whole movement is a movement of personal responsibility. And most people have lived their whole lives shirking as much personal responsibility as possible. Like, our society is literally set up in a way to have the least amount of personal responsibility to even like little things, right? Where everyone's getting sued for everything, you know, because it's never someone's own personal fault that something happened. There's always like three people you can blame that might have big money bags that you can hit them with, or every single aspect of our society lacks personal responsibility. And it's going to take a while for people to learn to take personal responsibility back. And I'm this weird pessimist optimist, where like my optimistic take is always that children need to touch the stove, and like people learn by getting burned, right? So I expect a lot of fucking pain, but then ultimately people learn and get rewired a bit into how they handle it. And I mean, I was talking to you earlier about my conversation with Dario of Moon Wallet with two U's, and you know, he's from Argentina, and there was like all these Argentinians, and a lot of them use stable coins, which, you know, everyone has different threat models. Everyone has different things that they're working on. But the most important thing to me when people are using these tools is that they understand the trade-offs. And he had spent years trying to educate people on the trade-offs of using stable coins and centralization risk. And a lot of them got burned on Terra. They were all holding Terra because they thought that was the decentralized stablecoin, quote unquote, compared to Tether. And they all lost all their money overnight. And that did more for education of the risks of centralized, you know, centralized currencies than any kind of education effort that ever came before that, right? But the unfortunate part is that people got burned. To the inevitable point, I kind of fall in between the two of you. I honestly do believe Bitcoin's inevitable. I don't believe freedom money is inevitable. I don't believe Bitcoin as freedom money is necessarily inevitable. I think Bitcoin is code, and at the end of the day, it's a movement of people, and it relies on people to actually stand up and fight for their freedom and defend their rights and use the tools. There's a very real possibility to me that, you know, Bitcoin becomes a global reserve currency of the world, that the purchasing power is significantly higher than it is today, but maybe 5% are actually using it in like a freedom sovereign way, and 95% of people are just using it in a completely cucked way. And so, I mean, that nuance I don't think is ever really captured in the Bitcoin is inevitable conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good middle ground. I think that's probably even closer to where I fall than I had thought about. Just that, like, the Bitcoin, the chain, Bitcoin, the currency is, I feel like we're probably at that point where it's not going to disappear. Like, I don't think Bitcoin's going to die. I don't think it's going to fail in a catastrophic way. But yeah, that way of like, what is its success in quotes actually mean in the future, I think is a very important question. And that's where a lot of the questions around mining centralization, around private usage, around Lightning, around all of these, around self-custody, all of these topics, I think are vital to decide what is this future that has Bitcoin in it, whether that's a Bitcoin standard, hyper-Bitcoinization, or just Bitcoin being another thing that's part of the current system. How are people who actually do wake up, who do get burned, who do realize the necessity of personal freedom and financial freedom specifically, what can they actually get out of Bitcoin? And I think that's where a lot of the wake-up calls for people need to come in those situations where people get burned. I think like the Freedom Convoy was a great example of people getting burned. And I think a lot of Bitcoiners woke up to some of the issues with Bitcoin privacy and with the approach to using Bitcoin for that specific use case and the things that go into that, the OPSEC, all of that. But I think more and more scenarios like that are going to happen. And it's really going to be, those are going to be the deciding moments in how useful will Bitcoin be and how much change will it bring for those people who do wake up, based on how we respond in those situations. So I hope that Bitcoiners stay open to feedback, stay open to the possibility of Bitcoin not succeeding perfectly, so that we can keep an eye out for the things that we need to focus on, the things that need to be improved, the things that need extra dev time, the things that need potentially changes on chain, like whatever needs to happen to make this the most useful thing. People kind of need to stay open to that. But it'll be interesting to see what the next kind of touching the burner moment is, because ultimately, I mean, the same applies for Bitcoin. It applies for personal privacy. It applies in almost every area where self-responsibility is involved. Something has to make you decide, I actually want to put in the time and effort and be responsible, because I know that what I gain from it is far more important. And so that's something where I'm curious what the next kind of moment of that is with Bitcoin. The North American mining centralization coupled with the push against proof of work should be scaring people, I think.
I don't know. I would love if they put mining restrictions in America.
Yes.
That would actually probably be kind of bullish, because specifically it'd be the warehouse public companies that got fucked.
Mm-hmm. And then you know what everyone's going to do? They're going to turn up that old S9 and they're going to spin it up in their garage. It's going to be great. But I kind of wanted to add to that thing you were talking about, burning your finger on the stove. So what I've noticed, I've picked up a pattern, and it's a very striking pattern. And look, you try to convince someone about Bitcoin and they live in a Western country, to use Gladstein's own words, they have financial privilege. Very hard sell. They're like, to use too much energy. I have Cash App. I have PayPal. I have Venmo. It's like, why does that need to exist? I pitch a Venezuelan or an Argentinian. I say, non-government money that is hard to confiscate, that can't be debased. And in 10 seconds, they say, how do I sign up? Because the difference between the two is that as an American, specifically in the beginning, you see Bitcoin as an investment. Whereas in the Argentine, the Venezuelan, the Afghani, right, they see it as a necessity. They don't have another option. And this is kind of the tragedy of stablecoins, right? And this is why I'm hate is a strong word, but I'll use the word, whatever that word is below hate. I don't like them because they give a false refuge. And Matt, you were actually telling us a story about the Argentines using Luna because they bought into the whole Tether FUD. and they got totally wrecked. And here's the thing. Stable what? It's stable on the way down? Is it stable 2%? Like, lose money slowly? Is that stability? Or is in Bitcoin, it's like, fine, yeah, it's volatile. But you look at the purchasing power of Bitcoin over 2 or 3 years, that thing's just going up. So how do we convince more people, specifically in countries that actually need it, right? And I would say in the West, they need it too, but they just haven't found that out yet. How do we convince people to stay away from these false safe havens and actually use something that will actually give them financial sovereignty? That I think is a very difficult problem to solve, but I think it's a solvable problem. Because the incentive, like, they're incentivized to understand something like that, right? Because in the United States, you're not incentivized, right? Like, let's say you have a good job, you have a good salary, you know, you have your 401k. You're like, okay, yeah, I like Bitcoin, it's cool, but you don't really understand the revolutionary aspect unless, like, you know, you start asking a little bit of questions, right? But the Venezuelan, the person El Salvador selling pupusas, this is a whole other debate.
I mean, so there's a couple of things here. First of all, just a little bit of history lesson for Bitcoiners. A lot of Bitcoiners think that stable coins were something that was like added post Bitcoin. But really, if you look at most of the pre-cypherpunk money of before Bitcoin, they all basically ended up having a trusted third party that had some kind of USD in a bank account or some kind of pegged value. The novel thing about Bitcoin is that you actually have this bearer token that exists only in the digital realm. So you're actually able to eliminate that final centralized third party. So, I mean, and just in general, I think that's probably where most people's heads go first, right? Which is, okay, I want digital money and I want it to be the same money that I want already. Right? That's a whole different education thing that I don't even know if it necessarily needs to be a top-down education or even a grassroots education. Like, I think that's a reframing of what you think about money, which is that money is not something that's issued by a state or a corporation. It's something that exists on its own in this digital realm. The idea of being able to send payments around the world with minimized trusted third parties and minimized censorship is something that people can grasp really quickly, which is why I think stablecoins have been very successful, particularly in parts of the world where their own government currency is fucking horrible. So they're like, okay, I can. And a lot of these people, they can't use like PayPal. They can't use Western Union or something because they get blocked out. The other thing is, so when I was in one of the interviews I did for this documentary series that's coming out is with Roya. And Roya started, she's from Afghanistan. In 2010, she started, I might butcher their name, but I think it's called Citadel Software Company. Way ahead of the curve on the Citadel meme. I asked her how she was way ahead of the curve, and she started it in a town that had like an old Afghani citadel in it. So she had a very good reason to use that. But her big thing was empowering women in Afghanistan. She was a woman in Afghanistan. She wanted to empower women in Afghanistan. 80% of employees were women in Afghanistan. And these women weren't allowed to have bank accounts. They needed permission from a man or a family member to have bank accounts. They were completely excluded from the financial system in their society. So the sell for Bitcoin, like you said, when you talked to like Venezuelans or Argentinians, was it wasn't even a sale. They had no other option. They had this need. They wanted to get paid. They wanted to be able to hold their own value. So they moved to Bitcoin. So in 2013, she started paying them in Bitcoin. She did massive education campaigns throughout the country, but they were all mostly focused on women because the women were excluded from the financial system. Mm. She had a good friend who rose. He became a very powerful politician in Afghanistan. And they would have these like spirited debates on Bitcoin. And he's like, our financial system is the best it's ever been in Afghan history. There's no need for me to use this thing that's like super volatile, blah, blah, blah. Taliban come into power, take over everything. They seize all of his assets, seize absolutely everything he owns. He escapes from the country like by foot across a border with just a backpack. Wow. Gets to the other side. Him and Roya start talking. He's like, I completely see why Bitcoin should exist. Right. And so you have this situation where one of the cool parts about Bitcoin to me is the disadvantaged see the power of this technology first, right? Because the people that are in power, the people that benefit from the current financial system, have no need to see it. They're going to get burned at a later date. But ultimately, it's inevitable for people to find the need somewhere, to get canceled out of these systems somewhere.
Absolutely.
She's awesome, by the way. Roya is really inspiring.
She sounds like an OG. The OG of the OG. Even came up with Citadel because there was an actual Citadel.
The Citadel software company. How cool is that fucking name?
That's crazy.
While I was interviewing, I was like, yeah, I have another show, Citadel Dispatch, but unfortunately, that's not the one we're recording on right now. It would have been too fucking perfect. I want to go back to the Freedom Convoy because I think this was a pivotal thing on the Western side of the world that I thought was going to be a... Like, I thought when people go back and they're like, what are the biggest events that happened in freedom technology in general or Bitcoin in general over the last year, Freedom Convoy would be probably the top thing that someone said. But I think if you ask the majority of people right now, they might not even remember that it happened.
Just like most people don't know the hash rate migration. They don't know unless you... have your finger on the pulse, right? I know I have a different of opinion than you, Matt, but I think it was a very big middle finger because
it was definitely a middle finger.
Dude, the state couldn't seize all of it. They didn't get their way. They only got their way, I think it was like on 20%, right? And they scared the crap out of a lot of people, but the vast majority is non-recovered. Like, when the hell? That never happens.
Yeah, but with GoFundMe, they like pressed a button and just all the money was taken, right? So like with Bitcoin, you can't do that. But most of the public organizers of that Freedom Convoy are engaged in civil lawsuits right now with the government for hundreds of millions of dollars.
What about...
So I don't think that story is over yet necessarily, right?
It's not over, but what about all the other unknowns that people... I would say... You know, this is why every time I see Ben, like, I'm like, dude, you're the man. And I was actually really lucky because I was on the first podcast that he did when he got back. When he stopped podcasting for a while, he stopped doing his show. I love his show. He stopped doing it for a while, man. And he came back, first show he did, it was me and James Lavish. And dude, like... the look on his face is like he went to war. But how many people benefited because of his actions? And if this is really a revolution like we say it is, isn't this part of it? Isn't this part of fighting for freedom? I don't know. And again, like I understand, and I might be a little bit biased here because I come from a country that was destroyed by collectivism.
Right, Venezuela.
And I come to America and it's the last bastion of freedom. And when I see people attacking that, I react very negatively, more so than someone that grew up here, because they don't understand how bad things could get. So I really see it from that angle. And I really appreciate all those guys, Jeff Booth, Greg Foss, BT, Ben. There's a couple others, man.
Nobody Caribou.
Yeah, they're warriors. They're in this different type of war that we're fighting. It's not a kinetic war. It's a different type of war. I can't really describe it, but yeah, they're legends, man. Even if it's not known to most people, I think that history will show otherwise.
What's your take here, Seth?
I mean, I think it's mostly forgotten because it doesn't mean anything to people who are just in Bitcoin for financial gain. Like the speculators could care less that the Freedom Convoy happened. I think there is something to say, even if you are just a speculator, that if Bitcoin didn't succeed in that scenario, and I definitely would not say that Bitcoin succeeded in that scenario or that Bitcoiners did. I'm definitely much more on the negative side of that whole thing, but I think it should have been, and I think it was not as much of a wake-up call as I expected, but I think it should have been a wake-up call to people that Bitcoin in its current state is not an amazing tool for freedom in these use cases. And we saw, I think a lot of the problems came down to just poor OPSEC and poor decisions. And that applies no matter what currency or cryptocurrency.
And a lot of it wasn't even Bitcoin related, right? Like just the fact that Nico just rattled out all the names that were involved.
Yeah. Everyone who was involved. That could have been avoided. They videoed all of the truckers who they gave funds to with their truck info and everything. Like, I mean, all that stuff was a major mistake if you actually wanted those people to be able to use those funds freely and not get tracked down. But I think we also saw with Bitcoin, like, yes, some of the funds were not confiscated as far as we know. We actually don't know if any of them are free and being used. We know that soon afterwards, 75% had not been moved from the wallets they've been sent to. All of this is transparent on chain. All of the wallets are tagged. Every output is blacklisted. We know that 75% hadn't been moved, so they hadn't been claimed by the people who they had been given to. And then we know 20 to 25% were confiscated because they were sent to KYC exchanges, where the exchanges obviously are cooperating and giving over names, IDs, and
like talk about an education shortfall when you have truckers who are, you know, fighting an oppressive government and they send it to Coinbase.
But the problem, and I think the real problem comes down to what you mentioned earlier about needing to drive circular economies. Because the problem was you give out this Bitcoin to people, which I think is it's a fascinating idea and very well-meaning. But you give out these Bitcoin to truckers who, all the politics aside, they needed fuel, they needed food, they needed real life things. And you gave them Bitcoin where there's no circular economy for the most part. There is some, like maybe they could have used like Bitrefill or something.
Did you see my tweet at the time, my idea? That like if we normalize protesters raising Bitcoin donations, we should also normalize Bitcoiners going to protests for no KYC free sats.
Yeah, yeah.
Like you just show up to a protest with like 500 local fiat, you know, and you just find a protester that has a bunch of Bitcoin they need to get rid of.
That would have been perfect. I mean, they needed people who could have
solves
taken Bitcoin and fill a gas pump, like pay for the gas pump. Right. That's one of the other problems is like if we have no circular economy in those scenarios, Bitcoin's kind of useless because you can store value, but you can't actually spend it and get real life things.
We have like the stepping stone stuff, like the gift cards, right? Like, so with like, might hate me for saying, well, their lawyers will hate me for saying this, but like the Bitcoin company, you can buy Visa cards via Lightning, right? So like those truckers, even with blacklisted UTXOs, they could have opened, or like if someone goes there and gives them cash for their Bitcoin and they're a Bitcoiner that knows what they're doing, they can then, you know, spend via Lightning to the Bitcoin company. The Bitcoin company doesn't know which UTXOs opened that channel. And then have a Visa gift card where they can spend everywhere. Like, is that ideal? No, that's not ideal, but
that would have been the best case.
And I see you talking about it all the time because like the Monero community loves coin cards, right?
Yeah. No, and it's a stopgap that is useful. And that's what I was saying. Like, that's the only thing they really could have done is convert to gift cards and use those. Although, to be honest, then wouldn't the better solution be just giving them gift cards? And
no, that's the problem. It's hard to give them gift cards, right? It's easy to send Bitcoin around the world.
It would be hard for, well, but people could have donated Bitcoin and then they just bought gift cards and handed that out to truckers with the donation.
I like that idea. Or like take the Bitcoin and just buy fuel and shit the truckers need and give the truckers that instead of just handing them Bitcoin and being like, good luck.
Yeah. The problem is it's fitting this use case. It's not just the self-sovereign HODL thing. It's that we actually need to spend and use it, which has, I think, been less of a focus in Bitcoin, in the Bitcoin community. But I think there is a good push right now. It feels like it for circular economy, for really kind of driving things. And whatever you think about Lightning, I think that's been one of the good things with Lightning is it's kind of brought back a lot of circular economy topics and a lot of actually spending Bitcoin and making it a useful tool, trying to drive merchant adoption, all of these things, which is really valuable. And I think a lot of the crux of the issue, because even if the UTXOs were known and blacklisted, if they could actually spend them, and then if the merchants knew how to properly handle them, it could have been okay. But obviously, the way that things went down was...
Because the blacklists are enforced at the regulated on-ramps and off-ramps. That's where they're enforced. There's no... I mean, I guess some of the gift card providers are probably also enforcing them as well.
Yeah, I'm sure pretty much anyone who could have received Bitcoin would have been liable for that. And they would have, I mean, the RCMP was actively monitoring those UTXOs to see when they moved to track them down. So, I mean, if you sent them
to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police.
Which I think is hilarious. The Mounties were tracking Bitcoin, but...
They show up to your house with like ARs on horseback.
you know the red suit that they wear?
We're here for your Bitcoin.
Where's the Bitcoin? Look, what I disagree with you a little bit, Seth. I would say that
if we look back in history, sorry, Matt, I have to lean in. If we look back in
history, he sees me like juicing this vibe. Yeah,
no, like, okay, I have to lean in. So I think if we look back in history, I think, you know, if we do the separation of money and state, if we're right, I think that the Canada event and the China event banning Bitcoin mining, the incentives come through, it's still there. The Canada thing, that's the only thing that the government could just couldn't snap their finger. And you could tell it put the fear of God in them.
Because Russia,
Russia had a press conference, right, with the Russian sanctions.
I mean, Russia got canceled. Like, average Russians, like, people can disagree on the whole political situation in terms of the Russian government, but, you know, just average Russians got completely canceled from the global financial system.
Yep, of course. And the thing is, like, is that worth it? Because the U.S. has done that to Cuba, and the U.S. did that in Afghanistan. And the example that you brought up earlier with the guy was like, no, the Afghan system is great. And then he fully understand. And Bitcoin is the only thing. I mean, it's not Bitcoin. It's Bitcoin and the goddamn stable coins, okay? Those are the only things that still work. Everything else doesn't work. So I think that if you look at it from a macro perspective, I think it was a very historical moment. I don't think Bitcoin failed. I think they didn't use Bitcoin's tools properly to fully exploit this, to fully go around the system, so to speak.
But don't you think it's a failure, at least maybe not a failure on Bitcoin, but it's a failure on Bitcoin promoters and educators and builders it shouldn't require so much education. Like if you go to Citadel Dispatch 57 in your favorite podcast app, like, I did a 2-hour episode following the Freedom Convoy because I was so broken by it, on how to raise Bitcoin crowdfunding in an authoritarian environment, an environment where you have an oppressive government that's actively trying to attack you and make your life miserable, close your bank accounts, put a gun to your head, seize your keys, and go after your donors, like people who are donating. And I think it was a very comprehensive conversation. I think most people could potentially, we tried to make it as accessible as possible, and I think most people could go and listen to that and definitely be in, you know, 100x better situation than the Freedom Convoy, where they reused addresses and made a lot of rookie mistakes, filmed the people they were donating to. But I know it's still early, so I want to lower my time preference a little bit and not be, you know, the angry, impatient person in the room. But I've been publicly talking about Bitcoin for 3 years now, so I get more grumpy old man as I go. But like, it shouldn't, the end case where we're going with Bitcoin, the ultimate goal should not be that someone has to listen to a 2-hour podcast before they raise Bitcoin donations in an authoritarian environment, right? Like, that's a failure on, maybe not on Bitcoin, but it's a failure on the people working on Bitcoin and working around Bitcoin.
I mean, as you said, Bitcoin's code. Like, Bitcoin is the people behind it. So if Bitcoin failed, it's the people who have been working on and building Bitcoin and educating all of those things, not maybe missing the point or missing the memo or not focusing on the right things. It's not that there's some, like, sacrosanct thing that has failed, but... I think a lot of it comes down to, like, are we still early? Like, we're over a decade in this experiment. Yes, it's code, but we've known about the majority of these issues for a long time. Chainalysis has been around since 2014. Like,
one of the most valuable companies in the space,
which is nuts and should tell you a lot about what you need to know about some of the issues that face Bitcoin. I don't know. The we're still early thing, the same thing hits me for Lightning, that it just feels like, it kind of feels copy, because I don't think we're that early.
I know, that's why I like smile when I say it a little bit.
Yeah, I wish there was video so they could have seen that. But I don't know, I struggle with that, because it's not a decade in software and a decade in this experiment with lots of these things being tried out at large scale by projects that shall not be named.
But Lightning hasn't, like, So one of my frustrations, I've been very publicly frustrated about some of the priorities in Lightning development, Lightning businesses, but these systems, you know, they exist, right, without centralized authority. And I mean, Lightning less or so, but with Bitcoin, like one of the key value props is extremely hard to change. So you need a lot of, and it's hard to measure what that threshold is. It's a rough kind of consensus type of situation, but you need a lot of motivation and momentum among all stakeholders to get any kind of real changes going on. Lightning to a lesser extent, but with Lightning specifically, it just has not existed in an adversarial environment. Like I've had this public Lightning node up since 2019. You know, it's the node that's being used for Citadel Dispatch podcasting 2.0. So if you stream sats, it goes to that node. Zero OPSEC on the node. It's called CitadelDispatch.com, you know, is the alias. Like, you know, it's my node. Ironically, when the shitcoiners were saying like it's going to be illegal to run a Lightning node, I sent out a drunk tweet during like consensus 2020 in New York because I was like drinking with a bunch of Bitcoiners. I was like, oh, damn it. Someone stole my node and put it behind Tor, but they're not closing channels and they're still keeping fees low. And like a bunch of shitcoiners were like quote tweeting me. They're like, see, Lightning's a failed experiment. I was like, okay, guys. But anyway, I had a buddy. He texted me the other day and he was like, I'm doing some Lightning privacy work and I'm trying to like probe for private channels. And he's like, can I probe your node? And I was like, dude, it's a public node. Like anyone can probe my node. Like you don't have to ask permission to do this. And he was like, yeah, but can I? I was like, yeah, you can. And then he was like, the next day, he was like, I hope you're fine with the 30 gigs of extra database entries that are in your node. And I was like, oh, that's why you're asking me? I didn't even realize that like any random person.
It's a lot of failed payments.
Can just fucking completely fill up your database disk space. Yep. So the point of the story is Lightning hasn't gone through that adversarial environment yet. Like you basically to expect Lightning to be robust without being attacked was never going to happen. What needs to happen is, and what will eventually happen with all of these systems, is they're going to get attacked like fucking crazy. And the crazy thing to me is that it hasn't really happened yet. Like if you look at the broader crypto space, I mean, we were talking about chain surveillance, like the whole DeFi thing that's happening on ETH where everyone just reuses the same account number. It's all like publicly out in the open. Like you hear about attacks where like certain things are getting drained or certain, but there hasn't really been like state level attacks, really comprehensive attacks. And these things are just never going to get robust until these attacks happen. Now, the hope is that the incentive structures that Nico was talking about really kick in once these systems get attacked and then the improvements are made. But until that happens, everyone's just, you know, on cloud nine smelling the roses.
Yeah, I mean, Lightning's a whole nother ballpark because it's also immensely complex compared to Bitcoin itself. So that like that one itself, that will take probably longer than Bitcoin does. So if we don't have great privacy on Bitcoin.
But it'd be a lot quicker if everyone's nodes start going down, right?
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think that's why I was hoping that the Freedom Convoy thing would be a little bit more of a wake-up call to people for the Bitcoin privacy issues. Because that was one of the first clear, large-scale Bitcoin-sponsored attacks on Bitcoiners. And it was a situation where people tried to use Bitcoin against the state. So I think that was one of the first like really good adversarial tests outside of Silk Road and some DNM usage and darknet market usage over the years. But that was an interesting piece and kind of why I was watching it and screaming on Twitter about them videotaping all of the truckers. But
it wasn't even a sophisticated state too. It was fucking Canada. Right? Yeah.
But I'm going to keep pushing back on you guys. I think that was a massive win. And, you know, I mentioned earlier that we were in this like new type of warfare and, look, I'm literally, my mic is on a World War II book right now.
The current state of the studio.
If you look at, I need a pleb mic, I guess. So if you look at, you know, war in general, right? World War II, they sent Shermans to the beaches of Normandy, but they sunk, right? Back in World War I, with the advent of the machine gun, they would just send cavalry into the machine guns and they realize, okay, perhaps machine gun and horses doesn't work out very well. Let's do trenches, right? And then they're like, okay, you know what? We need moving metal boxes, also known as tanks. The point that I'm trying to make is that if you see it from like a war standpoint, we won. Bitcoin itself did not fail. It worked. What failed was, okay, perhaps we shouldn't send the horses straight into machine gun fire. Perhaps we should take a different approach. And what I mean by that is I guarantee you next time, it will be totally different. But now we know, as the common, you know, the world knows, that you can raise funds, circumvent the state if you really want to, and you better make sure you do it right, because if you don't do it right, the Canadian Mounted Police is going to show up at your house on horses in red suits.
But I mean, they were lucky they were Canadians, right? Like, yeah. I was telling you this story about the Chinese activist who's, you know, her father just wanted basic civil rights. And this is not even a Bitcoin story. She just wanted basic civil rights for the Uyghurs. And he ended up in jail. They haven't been able to communicate with him, right? And the cousin gets sent to jail because she has a photo of him on her phone and they find it at a checkpoint, right? So the thing about the Freedom Convoy is there was some pain, but there wasn't much, which could be a very valuable learning experience without too much actual pain on people. But maybe it wasn't even enough pain, so people just feel like, okay, it was fine because, you know, no one's in a gulag right now.
Yeah, that's what it feels like. Because I don't know. I don't know how we can say that Bitcoin succeeded there. Like, yeah, it processed the transactions.
It did better than GoFundMe.
It did better, but is that success?
Well, I mean,
better than GoFundMe in a state-sponsored attack is a pretty low bar. Because GoFundMe is obviously going to go with whatever the state tells them. So, like, yes, it was better in that they were able to collect funds in a censorship-resistant way, which is that was an immensely powerful use case. So that was a good showcase of what can be done. Obviously, all the ways funds were handled, everything was poor. But as far as I know, none of the people who received funds were able to actually use them to buy anything, to fund what they were doing, anything like that, which I would consider as failure. I mean, yes, it was better and some funds got into people's hands. But
you're being a little bit hypocritical there, because like if people did successfully use those funds and we don't know about it, then that would be a success and we wouldn't know about it, right?
It would, but we would know about it because you can see what's happening on chain. The last report that I've seen on it, nobody had moved. Either people had not moved funds or they had been confiscated.
Or they had sent it to exchanges. There was no in between, basically.
Yeah. So if it has happened where people have actually used those funds effectively, then yeah, I would consider that a success. And that's really the bar I would say is like, was the purpose of the fundraiser met? Which is to get them funds that they could use to fund their protest.
Well, I'm going to use the war analogy, right? What did it prove? It proved that you could use an alternative monetary network to raise money, and it actually makes it very difficult for the state to seize successfully, especially if you do it right. And I guarantee you that now that certain Canadians have burnt their fingers, if that happens somewhere around the world next time, I guarantee you Bitcoin Twitter will mobilize. Matt O'Dell will go live on Twitter and be like, guys,
this is exactly
what you're going to do.
Listen to Citadel Dispatch 57.
So we'll like Twitter will mobilize and, you know, like the dent decentralized.
No, but that's not the case. What happened was really what happened. I mean, so we've been talking about the actual people raising the money. Bitcoin Twitter was really disappointing during it. Bitcoin Twitter, as soon as the pressure turned up, everyone fucking disappeared.
Horses into machine guns.
Like, though. Seth is, I think, a valuable person in the Bitcoin community. I think he might push back on that a little bit, but I think he's a very valuable person in the Bitcoin community. He was more outspoken than like prominent Bitcoin influencers, right? They just all were like, oh shit, like this could be the moment we all get called terrorists. And like they come for us, right? I mean, you were very vocal. I remember you being very vocal. I was very vocal. There were people that were vocal, but the overwhelming majority of people gave me the opinion that if my back is against a wall, they're all just going to let me go to the gulag.
Because
like, that is what's going
to
happen.
They don't understand. They don't get it that there is nowhere else to go. Like there is nowhere else to go. Like there is nowhere to escape. There is no like... You stand your ground here or you lose it. And what a lot of people, they have this false illusion where it's like, you know what, I'm just going to let this slide And, you know, I'm just going to, like, I don't want my life to get complicated. I don't want to get in trouble. Like, I don't want this, whatever. But I think we're at a crossroads in history where the fiat system in general has grown these bureaucracies to such a size. And I was actually reading Road to Serfdom. I wasn't reading. I was listening to it. Road to Serfdom.
Or audiobooks of shitcoin.
I like it. I like it, Matt. Not everyone's as hardcore.
Well, thank you for clarifying that you were listening. I hate when people say they were reading something and they were just listening.
No, I buy with my ears. I buy the physical books because I like to show them off on my shelf. Be like, I read that book. I really listened to it. It's kind of the same. But I agree. Reading has more of a...
Sorry for distracting you.
No, it's all good. It's a good comment. It's a good criticism. I just have too much ADHD. But look, I was reading Road to Serfdom and...
Listening.
Dude, these bureaucracies and this collectivism has reached such a size that you could, even in the U.S., where the founding fathers, man, the way they designed the country was great, but you could tell the system is being pushed to its limits, right? And this is not only happening in the U.S., it's happening in Canada, it's happening in Europe, and you have these giant bureaucracies that are trying to control people, man. So I think it reaches a point where you have to say enough is enough. And I think that in a way I'm privileged because I come from a country that I saw what happened, what collectivism did to the society. Venezuela went from one of the wealthiest countries in South America to literally a failed state in 20 years. And this people have this false illusion in the United States. Oh, it can't happen here. Oh, yes, it can happen here. And the way that it happens here is if you just shut up and say nothing. So that's why I was so vocal about it. And I think that if more people are vocal, and this doesn't mean like breaking the law or anything, like you have to color without inside the lines, but if all you have to do is stand up and say something. In my opinion, that's enough. Because if enough people do that, I think we win. That's my opinion.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah. So it was a little silence. I don't know if I said something wrong.
No, I mean, it was powerful. I just didn't know how to respond. So I just said, fuck yeah. Once again, I just, you know, we have the meme, I'm in it for the tech.
For the revolution, baby.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in it for the freedom. I would like to get wealthy in the process as well. Like, I'm not going to pretend like...
But it's a secondary aspect. Dude, Bitcoin is so awesome, Matt.
Well, I mean, you can't ever...
You don't have to worry about it.
You'll never be wealthy without freedom. So it's a prerequisite for wealth because otherwise it's not your wealth. The issue is not... I pretty much have faith that we will get there eventually. That, you know... The concepts are there. You know, the tech is possible. We're seeing it all unfold in front of our eyes. You know, the cat's out of the bag, the proverbial cat's out of the bag. Governments can't help themselves. Powerful people can't help themselves. They're going to keep oppressing people, and people will just naturally push back when they find the need. The fear to me, and the reason I'm so vocal about these topics, is the pain that happens in between. And I can see how palpable that pain can be and how brutal it can be. And there's an opportunity here to lessen that pain during that transitionary period. And so like a perfect example, I just keep bringing up examples. A perfect example is I talked to Navalny's team, main opposition to Putin, last year at the HRF event. And they've been raising Bitcoin donations for a long time. They use a static reused address. And I was like, you have me here with you. Like, can I please just walk you through, like, just improving this? I'm not like, I don't want you. You don't need to be full cypherpunk. Like, can we just improve this situation a little bit? And she said to me, kind of echoing what you said about the Canadian Freedom Convoy, is they can stop us on GoFundMe. They can stop us on bank transfers. This Bitcoin keeps coming through. We don't care that Putin knows how much Bitcoin we have. He can't take it from us. We're outside of the country, except for Navalny, who's in jail. But his whole operation is outside the country now, and or at least the public-facing parts of the operation. And they can spend it at will. And they and another aspect was they're like, we know Putin has the capabilities of spying on us from all these other things, which is something I talked about with Seth on on his pod, which is the meme. The real meme that stops people from seeking out better privacy is not, oh, I have nothing to hide, so why should I care? It's really, I'm so fucked that there's no improvement that can be made. So they gave me that argument, basically, right? And that it worked anyway. About 4 months ago, 5 months ago, it came out that Binance handed over all the KYC information of all the donors that donated to that reused address, right? That's a shit ton of pain that has gone to all anyone who contributed there from inside Russia, who has family inside Russia, is completely fucked right now. And so, like, did Bitcoin succeed in that scenario? Like, Navalny has a Bitcoin. Navalny's able to spend the Bitcoin. He wasn't able to do that through any other financial means. But, like, if a bunch of his supporters and their families are all being subjugated as a result of that usage of Bitcoin, was that a success?
Yes, because this is war. You have to take...
But you still don't go into war with no armor on, right? You don't, like, go to... Like, you don't... You should still not, like, run your cavalry into a machine gun,
but
your metaphor.
But Matt, like, we are, like, again, like, we're, like, in this weird place where... I wouldn't say weird because it's not weird from our perspective. We love Bitcoin. We're obsessed with it. We've based our careers around it. So obviously we're knowledgeable on how to fully use the tools that Bitcoin gives us in order to avoid those situations. But the world still hasn't found that out yet. And that's what happened with the Freedom Convoy. That's what happened with the example with Russia that you're giving me. And I'm going to kind of circle back to what you said earlier on the show about burning your finger on the stove. And that's why I use the analogy of the war. Sometimes in war, unfortunately, whole battalions get slaughtered. And then the next time the commander's like, okay, maybe I shouldn't send the horses to the machine guns. Maybe we should build a trench instead.
If we could reduce the slaughters,
yeah,
wouldn't that be ideal?
Yeah, horses suck. Let's do tanks. Yeah. You know, tanks are better.
But not land them at D-Day and have them sink.
Yeah, no, that would suck. That's a terrible idea. I don't know. I hope these analogies are useful.
I like analogies.
I'll piggyback off that analogy. I mean, I think we see a lot of the same problems that have been seen in war. And I mean, reading through the books that your mic is sitting on, a lot of the problems are the issues with approaches were known, and then something bad happens, and the ways to resolve that or ways to prevent that are forgotten, and it just keeps rehappening over and over again.
This is true.
And I think that's a good way to look at what has happened in Bitcoin, and that we have known about these problems, like the Navalny thing. Everyone's known you're not supposed to reuse addresses. It's been like a decade that we've known.
But the
whole
Ethereum ecosystem reuses addresses.
Well, because they don't have addresses per se. They have an account-based model rather than UTXO. So they have more technical reason to reuse addresses because their system is built to reuse addresses.
They just built it technically horribly.
Yeah. For privacy, yes, it is abjectly terrible. But within Bitcoin, obviously we have UTXO model, we have addresses, and we've known about address reuse. The problem is, and this comes back to what you were saying earlier too, the incentives are not aligned with privacy within Bitcoin. The incentives, like with the Navalny thing, they can get the bare minimum. They can get donations that are not easily seized with just posting a static Bitcoin address. It works, they get them, they don't care. But then you have all of the other problems that come with everyone knows how much Bitcoin you've received. Everyone knows how to easily watch what you do with that Bitcoin. Dusting attacks are very simple. Binance turning over all the KYC users, because you know if someone sent money to that address, it was to Navalny and his people.
One of my favorite things about that story, by the way, is when I tell people that story, they get outraged, but they're like completely cool with Binance handing all that KYC information to the U.S. government.
Yeah, I mean, just like I think many people were totally fine with all the KYC exchanges killing Russian people.
Sorry to cut you off.
No, you're good.
Remember what the Kraken CEO and Brian Armstrong kind of dipped his toes a little bit, but Jesse Powell, that's his name, right?
Mm-hmm. Jesse Powell of Kraken.
I get confused because I'm like Jerome Powell. Like, yeah, coincidence. Okay.
Different Powell.
I know, right? I'm like, is that the right last name? So he said it. Right, he said it. He's like, listen, guys, we can't help you.
He's like, don't use Kraken if you're doing
it. He's like, take self-custody. And then you see the reaction by the real, I'm going to keep saying it because it's funny, Royal Canadian Mounted Police.
Yeah, the Mounties.
Like, this guy is a problem, you know? And all he said, which is crazy to me, which is crazy.
I mean, and Brian Armstrong can go fuck himself, but Brian actually did as well to a degree.
He
I mean, and then they also did.
Jesse was like,
yeah, he was probably selling surveillance software to the Mounties while he was saying that tweet. Right?
I mean, they also did their own Chainalysis to hand over even more names than they than anyone else had for like the Russian
sanctions. Russian thing.
They went above and beyond, and were happy to build special tools for that as well. Which, no matter what you think of the political angle, that should show you the dangers of KYC.
That was an awesome post because usually these regulated exchanges are their lawyers prevent them from saying things, but with the Russian thing. They were really scared that their business was going to get taken down. So they gave like the Coinbase post about the Russian sanctions. They said like everything they do. They went down all the draconian paths of like how they control people and surveil people. Mm-hmm. That was a real. I thought that was going to be another big eye opener, but that's just memory hold as well.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. People forget pretty quickly, and I think that circles back to like what I've been harping on today. And what I constantly harp on is like, if things don't lead to changes in the incentive structure for Bitcoin, and not obviously like mining, that I'm not talking that type of incentive structure, but with the use of Bitcoin privately generally being disincentivized, it's going to cost you time, it's going to cost you fees, it's difficult. That's obviously not to say it's not worth it. It is necessary if you want to use Bitcoin and you want the most freedom you can gain from it. But the incentives are for the opposite. And if we don't use these examples to say, look at the way that Bitcoin as a tool was not as successful as it should have been. Maybe we don't say it failed. I don't know we can say it succeeded, but it at least was not as successful as it could have or should have been. We need to figure out how do we leverage that before people forget into doing the things that we need to do. And I think like obviously hard fork in Bitcoin, something like that, that's not going to happen. We'll be completely honest. But
well, there has to be at least one hard fork.
Well, yeah, eventually. Maybe we'll do all of the privacy changes in 2140 or whenever that is. But in the meantime, we can do things like incentivize wallets to start including Paynim, Bit47 support. We can start to incentivize more wallets to include things like Whirlpool, ways to easily mix funds. We can actually fund the people who are creating tools that are proven to work for Bitcoin privacy. We can start to do the other optional things that at least will improve the lives of those who wake up in some way.
I was talking to the BitRefill guys. What's the number one wallet that's used to spend Bitcoin at BitRefill?
Legacy?
What?
Legacy?
Like number one Bitcoin wallet that's used.
I have no idea.
It's Trust Wallet by Binance.
No. Are you serious?
Reused address.
Address type.
Complete reused address. They don't even do a new. I think number two is blockchain.info. No, by the way, freaks, no one uses these wallets that I'm listing.
Yeah. This is like the shame list.
Well, that's what I
want. Maybe I got the order wrong. Maybe Exodus was number one closed source wallet.
I'm sure Exodus is close.
And then it's very number two was Trust and number three was blockchain.info. Right. But anyway, those were the top three. I'm positive of that.
I think I mentioned.
But did you see the disconnect with Bitcoin Twitter? Like Bitcoin Twitter would never recommend any of those wallets.
Well, that's what I think I mentioned it earlier about the and this is the part that worried me is that the custodial aspect of Bitcoin is such a big leap for most people that they just want to use the easiest solution, but they don't understand the trade-offs. Like they have no idea that if you pick a good Bitcoin wallet, right? The amount of sovereignty that would give you versus these wallets is day and night. And they don't understand that because to them, they're just looking at UI and they're like, this UI looks better than that one. So to kind of go back to your point, maybe mm-hmm. it's a question of making the more Bitcoin privacy centric wallets, the UIs better so that the normies like that using better. Instead of using the horse wallets, they could use the tank wallets.
Well, I think like, look, everything has trade-offs, right? Everything in life has trade-offs. And when you want to talk about someone being ethical or unethical in the space, I think it's a good barometer of that is, do they disclose trade-offs when mm-hmm. they're aware of trade-offs? It's one thing if you're ignorant, that's probably not great if you're trying to educate people and you're ignorant about stuff, but at least disclose trade-offs when you're aware of trade-offs. And I think one of the disconnects in the Bitcoin space, and it has gotten better, is that you have like hardcore wallets that are very featureful that, you know, the enthusiast crowd use. And then you have, you know, super mainstream wallets that are shilled to Kingdom Come and have huge marketing budgets and that are horrible wallets. And that's what the majority of people use. Mm-hmm. And really, the thing that would push the needle the most in terms of the most users having a more sovereign experience is a trade-off balance in between that are, you know, maybe not as convenient as the mainstream wallets and, you know, not as sovereignty focused as the hardcore wallets, but a trade-off balance in between where they have a decent UX, they're accessible, but they're also taking the majority of privacy best practices into account by default. And I'm hoping, like, I think we are seeing more go that way. I mean, that is the samurai approach to a degree. It probably leans a little bit more to the hardcore side. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the shit that Samurai gets, it's mostly based on the trade-off they made to try and make it more accessible, which is that you can use it without your own node on a mobile phone.
Yeah.
So that was a noticeable decision that they made, though, right? Which was like, how many more people can actually use this tool if they can just boot it on their mobile phone and have no idea what a fucking node is? They get skewered on Bitcoin Twitter for that, right? And they also, you know, attack people all the time, can get very aggressive. But they're mostly skewered for that technical choice that they made.
Yeah, I think a middle ground would be nice, but it's difficult because a lot of the things you need to do for privacy on Bitcoin are just not simple, and a lot of them need interaction. So it's very difficult to find a middle ground that is privacy preserving beyond just the simple, like not reusing addresses, making sure that your change outputs match the script type of the address you're sending to, these simple things that can break some of the common heuristics. Implementing those things is definitely a necessity, but it's hard to get a very simple UX that also preserves privacy on chain in Bitcoin.
Why does that have to be on chain?
Because Lightning's not really ready yet. I mean, in theory, something off chain could be the solution. I mean, maybe you're trying to shill Fediment. I'm not sure.
You read my mind, Seth. How did you know it? Seth brought it up, not me.
Matt was just writing Fediment in huge letters behind him on the whiteboard.
Got a whiteboard behind.
I think
Fediment could be that trade-off balance that I was I was setting up Fediment.
Yeah, the hard part is you give up custody. So it's
you don't give up, it's not a single custodian.
No, but you give up custody. You're just saying, I want to give up custody to
It's like a multi-party custody model.
Yeah, right? So it's better than like using Binance Wallet. And they
or like Wallet of Satoshi or something, which is a fully custodial Lightning wallet.
And I don't know. It's hard for me to walk down that path because I feel like one of the things that is non-negotiable for me is custody. But the trade-off that you would get in something like Fediment with Minimints is you could use people that you have some reason to trust, whether that's Bitcoin Twitter plebs or someone you know by name.
Community members or something.
A community member, maybe in your local town. Maybe it's people in a meetup that you go to that you work together. Like there are some interesting ways that you could have. Yes, you give up custody. You no longer self-custody, but the people who custody it are at least not a nameless corporation that's benefiting off of you.
So, I mean, like Obi, who's one of the leads at Fediment, that's what he believes is going to happen. He believes there's going to be a bunch of small community Fediment wallets that are all interoperable with each other because they support Lightning and on-chain. But they all are providing privacy to each other and they're all handling that. See, the thing is, so custody is a non-starter for you, right? But what Nico was saying earlier is like one of the main trade-offs is people taking custody. So to me, it's almost a feature, not a bug of that. Like people could still use a hardcore wallet if they wanted to, and they can go the full sovereign route. You know, they can learn how to use CoinJoin. They can learn how to do collaborative transactions, use Lightning with a full node and get rid of their Lightning node after they use a little bit and refresh and go through all the fucking different trade-offs. The cool part about Bitcoin is that it is this protocol and this open monetary network that people can choose how they want to use it. Now, Fediments could kind of be that nice stepping ground for people that are not comfortable with custody because instead of trusting regulated exchange, you're trusting, you know, 15 community members and like a plurality of them need to steal your money or DOS you, and basically you're relying on them for uptime as well, not just stealing your money. Like you need them to make sure the system is running, so your funds can basically be effectively frozen because you just can't spend them because they're not online. But and the result is you get very strong privacy guarantees, mm-hmm. and then you get lower fees and better user experience and potentially easier onboarding definitely easier onboarding than self-custody. So it could be, you know, it could be a massive improvement for the average person using Bitcoin. And if you think about it from the Canadian trucker point of view, Canadian truckers are using a Fediment wallet. And now here's the key. I think the biggest pain point of, I mean, the privacy stuff really was very frustrating. The biggest pain point of the Canadian truckers to me was that Bitcoin enables us to be in a situation where you don't have to have a centralized fundraiser. Like GoFundMe relies on you to have your GoFundMe captain of Freedom Convoy that raises all the money and then deploys it. Mm-hmm. But with Bitcoin, really, the ideal situation should have been that all those truckers were choosing, because a lot of them were streaming anyway. They were on Instagram Live and Twitter Live, and they were streaming their faces. While they were doing that, they should have been able to say, and you can send me money to my wallet here. Now, with Fediment, that opens up that possibility. And the question is, okay, is that as state resistant as something like, Bitcoin as a protocol? No, of course not. But it might be state resistant enough if anyone anywhere in the world, including NIMS, can launch these federated mints, then maybe it's decentralized enough. Maybe it's censorship resistant enough. That's yet to be seen. There's no working product out yet. You know, I don't really like talking about things in theory, but they seem very close. And they have a good team working on it. So I'm pretty excited about it. But that's the kind of my point is that's the kind of project that I want to see more of, that kind of stuff where it's practical benefits for average users that don't rely on any protocol changes or anything. It's like, okay, these are the tools we have available for us now. People are going to use the worst tools if we don't provide better tools. And, you know, it can improve things today. Is it going to be perfect? No, but it can improve things today. So I personally hope that a year from now, the conversation becomes very different just because the Fediment project exists and the Fediment wallets will be out in the wild.
Yeah, my I think optimistic view for that is that it turns into an onboarding tool, a tool for spending. Even if you can self-custody and you can do all these things, it will probably be a lot easier to use something like Fediment, where you use it as like a checking account. Like, you don't put your life savings in there because you are giving up custody and you should not do that lightly. But if obviously all these things come to fruition, you can use it as a checking account. You peg in or whatever it would be called to get into Fediment, and then you use those funds to spend and you just top up when you need to. But also obviously the onboarding tool where you can bring people in and then you teach them about self-custody, and it can be a better on-ramp with people who you trust. And I think it may have a lot of similarities in kind of how the privacy tool ecosystem works, where a lot of companies bootstrap or exist in good jurisdictions that are friendly towards privacy, that have good data laws that won't be oppressive. And we may have to say something similar with something like Fediment, because I mean, a big concern for me is still there are now less people in control of more funds. And so there's easier pressure points for governments.
The other thing though, I've just been obsessed with Fediment, and I've like, I mean, I had the fortune of I was in rural Norway, like all the way above, like in the Arctic Circle with Obi for 3 days. And I just wouldn't let him not talk about it. That's all I could talk about. But one of the interesting trade-offs that they choose to make is that the Federation doesn't choose who the Lightning providers are. So anyone, it's actually technically a permissionless way of being the LSPs. So like you could imagine like a Fediment wallet where, okay, you have 13 of 15 or 10 of 14 or something in the Federation, but then you have four different Lightning providers for that whole wallet. And basically, the Lightning provider, the person running that node and collecting the fees and running it as a Lightning service provider, they're trusting the Federation to a degree because they're choosing to accept the mint tokens, right? They're accepting the IOU shitcoin that is running in there that is technically pegged to Bitcoin, but the participants in the actual Fediment aren't trusting the Lightning node. And that was an active decision they made, because that is a clear pressure point, right? Which is, you get all these funds in a Fediment wallet, who's running the Lightning node?
So it doesn't have to be a Federation member?
Yeah, you don't even, they don't even necessarily have to know who's running the Lightning node.
Interesting.
It just has to be someone who's willing to take, trust that they can take the tokens and convert them back to Bitcoin eventually.
But then that Lightning service provider would have to have their own Bitcoin to match the liquidity.
Correct.
That the Fediment, that Minimint, I guess, would actually need. Yep. So you'd need people with a lot of Bitcoin. But that's very interesting. I just assumed it would be the Bitcoin that was custody that would be used in the Lightning node, but I guess not if the Lightning service provider can be.
The Lightning, my understanding is the Lightning service provider can do redemption transactions on chain for the mint tokens to Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, they need original liquidity when they first come in and start providing.
Fascinating.
Let's talk a little bit about the unintended consequences of this. Wouldn't you say this would still be normalizing something that isn't self-custody?
Yeah, but I mean, also like hardcore Bitcoiners like go to El Salvador and pay with Wallet of Satoshi. So I'm like kind of done with that conversation. Like you can't let the perfect be the enemy of good, at least for like short-term stuff. Look, at the end of the day, the trade-offs need to be made clear, right? Just like Seth said, like, you're giving up custody. You are there. This is a trust minimized system. It's not a trustless system, right? But it's very practical. It's a cool practical tool. I like the practical shit that like you can use sooner rather than later that actually bring tangible benefits to people.
How could it fail? Like, how could you? Because I'm really not. I'll be honest. I'm really not familiar with this solution.
No one really is.
What are the downgrades? Like, I'm sorry. What are the trade offs? Like, what if those 15 people aren't available?
Yeah, I mean, that's a major trade-off.
Your then all of
a
sudden, just like if Wallet of Satoshi backend goes down, or Blue Wallet, L&D Hub goes down.
I think
down,
like Liquid is probably a good example there. Like Liquid's gone down in the past.
How many of those 15 people do you need?
Well, so like it doesn't have to, I just keep using the term 15. Like OB thinks like small communities will be like a 3 of 5 or
so
something like that.
It's a multi-sig.
It's essentially a multi-sig. The way you can conceptualize it is that it's a multi-sig custody.
Those 5 people always online, always willing to sign. Is that type of the model?
The threshold needs to be online or whatever. So the threshold that can steal is the same threshold that can.
Is there like a verification process? Like, is it? Or
is... That's part of the beauty of it, is anyone can start a Minimint. So it
what?
Sorry, I think Minimint is like the concept of this, the actual, that's the software's name itself and what the idea of the smaller Federation is. So like you and I and Matt could just start a 2 of 3. I mean, I don't know if you want to do a 2 of 3, but we could start a 2 of 3 Minimint and we could have our own and no one needs to know that it's even us if we didn't want to, but we'd probably want people to know it's us so they trust us.
I think you'll have like big public ones and then you'll have smaller ones that are run by NIMS or community members and stuff like that. And they're all interoperable with each other.
But what's the point of big public ones? Doesn't that end you right where you started?
It's certainly
no, because you have privacy from the custodian. So I mean, a good example here, it just doesn't work that well as an example because of just most people aren't aware that how it even works. But like the Bitcoin Beach wallet, Galois wallet, is most funds are held on chain. That's a community multi-sig. And then they have a Lightning node that they run. And so the whole wallet is a custodial wallet, but it's trust minimized to a degree because the majority of funds are held in a multi-sig, so not a single entity can go and take the funds. Now, the result is a wallet that was extremely easy to use for, you know, tech illiterate Salvadorans. And it's been very successful in least terms of adoption. No one's gotten rug pulled yet. Obviously, they could get rug pulled at any time. But the big thing missing there is privacy. Like those custodians see every transaction and every balance you make. Every balance you have and every transaction you make. With this setup, you have privacy from the custodians. And that's more important than just trusting the custodians. I mean, the custodians are obviously an easy pain point that, you know, a government can come in and be like, okay, give us the roles of everyone's transactions.
But they couldn't even, one of the beautiful things about using Xiaomi and eCash as like the core of the system is they couldn't turn over any transactional details about you. Exactly. And they can't know, even you make a Lightning transaction or receive, they can't know who within the users of the Minimint that's actually destined to or from. So that is one of the great things is like, if the government's knocking, yes, the government could confiscate funds. So that is a problem. And right. that's what people should be aware of. But they can't give over the information about what you've done, who's transacting with who, that kind of thing. So that is
arguably
a big part.
Could be even more important sometimes than the funds, depending on people's start models.
Yeah, especially if you're using it as like a checking account where it's like, yeah, I lost $500, but they know nothing about the transactions I made. They don't know that I donated to Navalny or whatever, which is a very important piece of it. Yeah.
So it's not a tank. It's not a horse. It's like an armored car.
I love your analogies.
It's an armored car.
Freaks,
bro.
Make sure you go listen to Simply Bitcoin if you love Nico's analogies. What do you think is an armored car? Why is it an armored car?
Because it's, you know, like, look,
you trust driver.
No, but like, think about the machine gun thing, right? The armored car could only take so many bullets, right? And you know, the windows are gonna get, you know, kind of messed up a little bit. The horse is gonna die, and the tank's not gonna care. So it's an in between. That's why I think it's an armored car.
I would say maybe it's like a Toyota Camry with tinted windows. So let me explain my analogy. Obviously, I'm not the analogy guy here. We've talked about a lot in Bitcoin for a long time, which is that we're never going to really have accessible privacy if it costs more and is more difficult to use Bitcoin privately than not, because mm-hmm. just incentives. Yeah. Everything in the space is incentives, mm-hmm. And if you look at most of the broken things in our current society, it's broken incentives. Yeah. So with this, you know, if you were just a dumbass user and you were just sending, you know, all your funds on chain in the cheapest consolidated transaction possible, like this most compact on-chain transaction that's horrible for your privacy. Like every time fees go up on chain, you see like all influencer accounts are like, oh, combine all of your UTXOs because fuck privacy. You just want to have, you know, you want to have cheaper fees. You compare someone doing that, the most naive, worst Bitcoin transaction from privacy point of view, you compare them doing it on Fediment. They have a cheaper transaction. They have a faster transaction. They have a more user-friendly transaction with no confirmations or anything. And they have more private transaction. So it actually hits the incentives, at least from the user point of view, extremely well. And I'm, you know, once again, jury's out on how effective, how much these claims will be true when this stuff actually comes out. And we'll see. I usually don't like talking about things until I'm playing with it in person. But to me, this seems like an important enough project that I'm trying to get them extra developer help. So by talking about it, it gets them more support there. And I, you know, so that's why I'm talking about it. But I'm also talking about it because I think it's a good role model of a type of project where they're thinking out of the box and they're using the tools we have today. And they're not expecting some kind of protocol change in Bitcoin that we're never going to fucking have.
I understand the tinted window.
Right, Toyota Camry with tinted windows. Accessible privacy. Anyway, guys, we're at the hour and 40-minute mark. Seth has another interview he's got to do after this. I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, and we didn't really know where we were going to go with it, but I think...
kind of like the no-topic chat.
Yeah, it was fun. I appreciate you guys joining us. There'll never be a first rip in this studio again. So you guys are officially the first rip in the studio.
Honor.
The honor is mine. I like to wrap up the show with final thoughts. Seth, final thoughts.
Ooh, hard to sum up all the different things we touched on today. I think final thought would just be try to leverage these adversarial events that Bitcoin's going to wade into as fire for you to work on how you handle Bitcoin, how you approach privacy, and then also try to use it to push your favorite wallet, your favorite tool within Bitcoin, your favorite merchant, whoever, to think more deeply about maximizing the freedom that Bitcoin can bring. And with the way Bitcoin is today, that means going through some hoops to use it properly. But hopefully with things maybe like Fediment or other tools, we'll be able to improve that over the long run and give people different sets of trade-offs. Like I said, always going to be trade-offs, but different sets of trade-offs. So yeah, don't let these events become just kind of memory hold and lost, but use them as incentive for you and incentive for others to improve and grow and take on more responsibility.
Thanks, Seth. Nico, final thoughts.
Yeah, first of all, super honored to be here, man. Thanks for the invite.
It's been a long time coming.
Appreciate it, brother. Awesome studio. I see the potential. I see it.
We were supposed to record Simply Bitcoin, yesterday?
Yeah, we were.
So instead we did Dispatch in person. We'll do Simply at the end of the month.
That's a great surprise, man. So here are my final thoughts. I'm a little bit more militant than Seth.
Seth's highly militant.
We have a chance for freedom, right? And it's going to be casualties. It's going to get a whole lot harder. So you have to really ask yourself, what are you in this for? Are you in this for just the wealth? Are you in this for freeing mankind? Do you want your children to be free? And these are all questions that you have to ask yourself. What are you really in this for? And I think that if enough people take self-custody, if enough people are in this for the freedom, I think we have a really good shot at winning this. Just got to bunker down and to steal your line, stay humble, stack sats.
Let's fucking go. I want to thank our guests. I want to thank all the freaks who tuned in and listened live. Huge thanks to all the freaks who continue to support the show and keep it ad-free. Reminder, you can support at citadeldispatch.com or in your favorite podcasting 2.0 app. If you don't have sats to spare, consider telling your friends and family to type Citadel Dispatch in their favorite podcast app and press the subscribe button. It does help. I will see you freaks tomorrow, since I left you hanging for 3 weeks. I'm going to do a back-to-back dispatches. And tomorrow in the same studio, we're going to be recording with Texas Slim, who I guess is Tennessee Slim this week, and Carlinho from Ibex, and Michael Atwood from Oshi. It's going to be a great conversation on bootstrapping a circular economy. I'm really excited for it. I hope you guys are excited for it. To quote Nico, stay humble, stack sats. Cheers.